Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Studio 18 in Campo Robles, Spain. Tonight's episode is our 43rd and is the second part of a two-part summer reading series that we call Terrae Incognita. It's an exploration of J.K. Wright's famous 1946 presidential address to the American Association of Geographers. In it, we find many elements that fit in with what we're doing here on the show, namely the concept of geosophy, or the study of geographical thinking from any and all points of view. The geographical imagination, if you will. Stay tuned tonight as we finish the reading. We have two sections left, and then we are joined by Professor John L. Allen from the University of Wyoming and previously of the University of Connecticut, who helps us put into context and actually gives us some more rich details around the address and around the impact that this address has had within the academy, within the discipline of geography, especially in the United States. And we consider what that would look like, the idea of geosophy as a field of study. So without anything else, let's continue the reading and then meet with John Allen. Hope you enjoy. Borrowed imaginative impressions. We are under no compulsion to rely exclusively on our own imagining or to make use solely of its original products. The imaginative perception of others, the feeling for place that many a sensitive traveler has recorded, may be keener and more accurate than ours and may often be borrowed to advantage. In interpreting the landscape of Iceland or of Arabia, one might do better to quote here and there from Lord Dufferin or from Doughty than to try to give one's personal impressions. It is a standard practice in the teaching of history to cultivate the student's sense of time and contemporaneity by requiring him to read selected passages from documents written in the periods that he studies. No less valuable in the teaching of regional geography would appear to be the cultivation of the student's sense of place by requiring him to read passages from works in which the feeling for place has been most effectively expressed. Furthermore, even though we may prefer not to borrow directly from others, our own responsiveness to the siren song is rendered more acute by reading the words of those who have also heard it, and the whole tone of our writing and teaching is enriched thereby. The realm of geography in the sense of all that has been written and depicted and conceived on the subject, consists of a relatively small core area, to borrow Whittlesey's phrase, and a much broader peripheral zone. The core comprises formal studies in geography as such. The periphery includes all of the informal geography contained in non-scientific works, in books of travel, in magazines and newspapers, in many a page of fiction and poetry, and on many a canvas. Although much of this informal geography offers little of value to us, some of it shows an insight deep into the heart of the matters with which we are most closely concerned. I venture to think that of two geographers equally competent in all other respects, the one the better read in the imaginative passages in English literature dealing with the land of Britain could write the better regional geography of that land. The peripheral zone also includes another, even more informal type of geography, that of the subjective geographical conceptions of the world about them, which exists in the minds of countless ordinary folk. In order to estimate what these are, we seldom need to go as far as the sociologists do in making ostensibly scientific inquiries into human attitudes. By talking sympathetically with a few intelligent folk on the ground, by consulting the files of local newspapers and other publications, and by a little adept use of intuition, we may, under most circumstances, gain all that is required for our purposes. For example, the farmers of the Great Plains must look with certain sentiments on the massing of thunderheads after a long drought. Why not give life to our regional or climatological studies of the plains by letting the reader sense this feeling? That it combines a hopeful expectancy of rain with a dread of tornadoes is a reasonable surmise, even though suggested subjectively by the imagination and only partially confirmed by conversations, rather than established rigorously on the basis of comprehensive interviews or questionnaires concerning exactly what the farmer's attitude toward the breaking of a drought may be. Geography and human knowledge. I've tried to suggest some legitimate and desirable uses of the imagination in geography. I should now like to call attention to a broad domain that lies open for much more intensive geographical investigation than it has hitherto received. Human knowledge is generally regarded as a phenomenon of considerable importance on the face of this earth. It may be made the subject of two types of geographical research. We may either study the geography of any or all forms of knowledge, or else we may study geographical knowledge from any or all points of view. The geography of knowledge is that aspect of systematic geography which deals potentially with knowledge and belief of all kinds, whether religious, scientific, philosophical, aesthetic, practical, or whatever else. The various forms and manifestations of knowledge are investigated in the light of their distribution and aerial relationships, precisely as landforms, cities, languages, and other categories of terrestrial phenomena are investigated in other branches of systematic geography. Human knowledge, of course, is taken into account incidentally in many of these other branches, and also in regional geography. Attention, however, is there concentrated on the results that knowledge produces on the face of the earth, rather than on the geographical nature of knowledge itself. Though closely allied to cultural geography, the geography of knowledge differs from the latter to the extent that knowledge itself differs from culture. Knowledge is more fluid than culture, often spreading rapidly from one culture area to another without fundamentally altering established patterns. The sociologists have developed the sociology of knowledge more consciously and perhaps more systematically than we have developed the geography of knowledge, and would probably regard the latter as merely a part of the former. This need not trouble us, for there are many phases of geography in which we may profit from explorations conducted by others than ourselves. Though the possibilities of research into the geography of knowledge are attractive, I wish to dwell here, and now more particularly upon the second type of investigation, the study of geographical knowledge. As there is no accepted term for this field comparable to musicology or historiography for the study of musical or historical knowledge respectively, I shall yield to the geographer's perennial temptation and coin one. My term is geosophy, compounded from ge, meaning earth, and sophia, meaning knowledge. Although this suggests theosophy, there is no connection, nor should geosophy be confused with geosophistry and geopedantry, both of which have been known to flourish. Also, lest you misunderstand, I'm not trying to introduce any of these terms into the literature of geography. Geosophy, to repeat, is the study of geographical knowledge from any or all points of view. To geography, what historiography is to history, it deals with the nature and expression of geographical knowledge, both past and present, with what Whittlesey has called man's sense of terrestrial space. Thus, it extends far beyond the core area of scientific geographical knowledge, or of geographical knowledge as otherwise systemized by geographers. Taking into account the whole peripheral realm, it covers the geographical ideas, both true and false, of all manner of people, not only geographers, but farmers and fishermen, business executives and poets, novelists and painters, Bedouins and Hottentots, and for this reason, it necessarily has to do in large degree with subjective conceptions. Indeed, even those parts of it that deal with scientific geography must reckon with human desires, motives, and prejudices, for unless I am mistaken, nowhere are geographers more likely to be influenced by the subjective than in their discussions of what scientific geography is and ought to be. While it is true that subjective ideas may be studied objectively up to a certain point, geosophy certainly is not a field in which one may apply the stricter methods of analysis possible in the physical sciences and physical geography. I doubt, however, that on this account any geographer in his senses would hold geosophy to be either illegitimate or undesirable. Its value both to ourselves and to the others whom we seek to serve requires little defense. Geosophy can provide a background and a perspective indispensable to our work. It can show us where the ways in which we observe and think fit into a larger scheme. By helping us better to understand the relationships of scientific geography to the historical and cultural conditions of which it is a product, it can enable us to become better-rounded scientific geographers, when that is our purpose. Recognition of its function in these respects is implied by the methodological discussions in which many American geographers take delight, and specifically by the emphasis that Sauer, Brown, Whittlesey have and others have placed of late on values to be derived from the history of geography. There are many possible approaches to the study of geosophy. Let us consider two of these, the cartographic and the historical approaches.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode.
Cartographic geosophy. The cartographic approach to geosophy involves the making of maps that present information about the distribution of geographical knowledge. Obviously, every map tells us something in this regard. A geosophic map is one designed specifically for the purpose. Such maps might be grouped in two main categories. The first would comprise maps that present facts relating to what is or has been known about different areas. By far, the most common of these are maps showing areas that have been surveyed and mapped in various ways, for various purposes, and with varying degrees of intensity and accuracy. Cartosophic maps, in other words, because they depict cartographic knowledge. In the same category, however, would also belong maps of the world as known to the Greeks or Romans, or of the United States as supposedly conceived by Ralph Brown's friend Mr. Keystone in 1810, or perhaps by the average contemporary Bostonian. The second group would comprise maps that reveal facts concerning geographical knowledge, present or past, in different areas or at different places. This is an almost completely virgin field for ingenious experimentation. A dot map, for example, showing the distribution of members of the Association of American Geographers and the American Society for Professional Geographers would disclose information of considerable interest regarding the distribution of geographic knowledge in North America, especially if each dot were colored according to the quality and made proportional in size to the quantity of geographical knowledge in the mind of each individual represented. Whether or not this particular geosophic map would be either feasible or desirable, geosophic maps in general bring out sharply the contrast between the shadows of ignorance and the light of knowledge. Terrae incognitae of various forms and degrees stand forth clearly upon them to arouse our curiosity. Historical geosophy, or the history of geography. The historical approach to geosophy implies the study of the history of geographical knowledge, or what we customarily call the history of geography. This subject is usually understood to deal with the record of geographical knowledge as acquired through exploration and fieldwork, and as formalized and made into a discipline. Most of the work that has actually been done in the field has been restricted to the core area of geographical knowledge to the exclusion of its peripheral zone. There is, however, merit in conceiving it more comprehensively. I have already suggested that geographical knowledge of one kind or another is universal among men, and in no sense a monopoly of geographers. All persons know some geography, and I venture to think that many of the animals do also. However, it may be with the animals such knowledge is acquired in the first instance through observations of many kinds, from the Stone Age man's view of distant ranges to the precise geodetic measurements of today, aided by the use of electronic devices. Its acquisition, in turn, is conditioned by the complex interplay of cultural and psychological factors. The data with which it deals with fall within the scope of each and every one of the natural sciences, the social studies, and the humanities. Its conceptions range from the purely personal, subjective impressions of a farmer or a hunter to those gained by rigorous mathematical calculations and highly refined statistical correlations, and find expression not only in scientific forms but throughout literature and art. Indeed, nearly every important activity in which man engages, from hoeing a field or writing a book or conducting a business to spreading a gospel or waging a war, is to some extent affected by the geographical knowledge at his disposal. If, therefore, the history of geography be conceived as potentially embracing all of the geographical knowledge of the past and its various relationships of cause and its effect, it is an immense subject indeed. It is, however, no more immense than certain subjects of which the teaching is being promoted today, notably the history of science or of the humanities in general, of contemporary civilization, and has, besides, one advantage over these, in that it ties together with a unifying thread, that of geography, a record of wide and representative segments of human enterprise, thought, emotion, and techniques. For this reason, I submit that it is a subject of which the investigation and the teaching offer superb educational and cultural values. In aspiration, I shall conclude by expressing an aspiration, quite impractical, no doubt, and not to be taken too literally. My aspiration is that there might one day be established in some of our universities or colleges chairs of geosophy and the geography of knowledge. The purpose would be to increase the effectiveness of geographical research and education by broadening their scope. One school of thought has held that the effectiveness of geography can be increased only by limiting its scope, but this school would seem to confuse the effectiveness of geography as a discipline or profession with that of the individual geographer or existing university department. The more general tendency today is to stress the need of better linkage between geography and other subjects, notably ecology, soil science, agricultural and industrial economics, and cultural anthropology, and not a few regret the loosening of ties with geology and the various branches of geophysics. To the desirability of establishing and re-establishing such contacts, I would add, as no less desirable, the re-establishment of closer connections with history and the humanities. In the periphery that lies outside the core area of scientific geography, there are alluring terrae incognitae. If we ourselves do not personally feel equipped or competent to conduct excursions into them, should we exclude them from the scope of our sympathies? Although most of us are committed to the advancement of scientific geography along straight and narrow paths, and would do well not to deviate too far from the directions in which they lead, we may at least extend our interest and encouragement to those who daringly strike out upon other routes. There is something to be said for considerable scholarship, as distinguished from science alone, as our métier. All science should be scholarly, but not all scholarship can be rigorously scientific. Scholarship, moreover, embraces not only the natural sciences and social studies, but also the humanities, the arts and letters, inquiring no less into the world of subjective experience and imaginative expression than into that of external reality. The terrae incognitae of the periphery contain fertile ground, awaiting cultivation with the tools and in the spirit of the humanities. The professors whom I have in mind would develop their subjects along different lines according to their tastes. Some might specialize in the geosophy of scientific geography, in its history, its methods, and perhaps in comparative biographical studies of the careers of individual geographies as bearing on the larger progress of geography. Others might concern themselves with geographical conceptions, both scientific and otherwise, as influencing and influenced by particular human activities and motives, or with particular categories of geographical knowledge in relation to the changing tides of doctrine and opinion. At least one or two should surely devote themselves to what might be called aesthetic geosophy, the study of the expression of geographical conceptions in literature and in art. Literary historians, but few geographers, have followed the siren's call into these terrae incognita. Need we leave their exploration wholly to the literary scholars? One function of my hypothetical professors of aesthetic geosophy, though God forbid they be called by such an atrocious title, would be to prevent the oncoming generations of geographers from becoming too thickly encrusted in the prosaic, and to render the study of geography more powerful than it would now seem to be in firing the artistic and poetic imaginations of students and public. These professors should be scholars in the humanistic sense, men widely read in the classics of geography, and also in general literature and literary criticism and history, masters of a style not only clear but restrainedly artistic. Their writings might help raise the standards of geographical writing as a whole. Their research and teaching would be directed toward the discovery and interpretation of geographical truth, belief, and error, as they find and have found literary and artistic expression. As long as they did not come to regard themselves as the only true exponents of what geography ought to be, there would be little danger of their exerting an adverse effect upon the advancement and the prestige of scientific geography. They could do much to keep our ears open to the siren song and make our voyaging into geographical unknowns a perennially satisfying venture, for perhaps the most fascinating terrae incognitae of all are those that lie within the minds and hearts of men.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. Geographical Imaginations is a growing multimedia public geography initiative designed to bring together academic and everyday geographical or spatial thinking. We believe everybody is a geographer and a co-maker of spaces. As an inquiry-based project, we ask questions and explore themes through dialogues with different texts and voices. Inevitably, our explorations return to simple yet complex questions. How does blank inform the way I picture the world in my head? And how does that picture in turn limit or expand my place in the world? The main focus of the project is this hour-long radio essay program broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. In each episode, we make brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. We reflect upon our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. While many of the episodes deal with local and regional topics, themes are somewhat universal, and our investigations could inform the geographical imaginations of those living anywhere in the world. Now let's get back to our episode.
There you have it. The entire address, presidential address to the
Association of American Geographers in the end at the end of 1946. Then President J.K. Wright, this was his honor to be able to give this address to his colleagues, geographers, both professional and academic, graduate students, all who are a member of that organization that brings together then geographers from the United States and perhaps abroad, but even more so now in the 21st century. It's the premier geographers conference, maybe even in the world. But we'd like to extend our gratitude once again, thanks to the AAG for letting us read this text in its entirety. I think it's an important one. And we're going to put it in further context today and in the remaining minutes of our episode here, our 43rd episode. We are going to speak with John L. Allen, who knew J.K. Wright when Allen was a graduate student, albeit he was J.K. Wright was not his advisor. He did have a sort of mentor-mentee relationship with Wright, and we're going to call him up in Wyoming. John L. Allen is the former chair of the Department of Geography and is emeritus professor of geography at the University of Wyoming in Laramie. He also taught many years, in fact, I think 30 plus years at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. Allen's publications, more than 30 titles to date, and they reflect a broadly varied set of interests, including the exploration of the American West, human impacts on natural environments, and landscape changes, and images of the West. He's a student of the Lewis and Clark expedition, of the thinking of Thomas Jefferson at the time of the Northwest, of opening up the American Northwest. His best known work is precisely on that. It's Lewis and Clark in the image of the American Northwest. He, like I said, comes to us from Laramie, Wyoming. And we want to talk to him today about a few things. Geosophy itself, what that means. J.K. Wright and the sort of the timing of this address that he gives and how that fits into the maybe the trajectory of the discipline of geography, but also where it came from, and maybe a little bit more of a personal story there. And then lastly, we want to ask about this last part that J.K. Wright frames for us in his address, and that is the idea of a chair of geosophy, whether that's in a geography department or somewhere at a university. I think we might even here at the Geographical Imaginations Expedition and Institute, we might even consider thinking about what that would look like for us, a chair of geosophy at the Institute. So without anything else, John L. Allen comes to us from Wyoming.
After this reading of J.K. Wright's presidential address, the 1946 address, I'm curious how you define geosophy, and maybe we could even think about it as it was defined then, and then even how it might help us think about geography and geographical knowledge today.
I guess my definition of it wouldn't vary appreciably from Jack Wright's, sort of the history of geographical thought, and more critically for his thinking, and not just the thinking of geographers, but the thinking of all kinds of people. In his memorable phrase of Bedouins and Hottentots.
Right, the most often quoted phrase from his address, which is taking into account the whole, or taking into account different geographical ideas, both true and false, of all manner of people, not only geographers, but farmers and fishermen, business executives, poets, novelists and painters, Bedouins and Hottentots. So it's the geography from, is it any and all point of view, points of view? Is that?
Yeah, I would define it that way. I also would add the component of the impact.
Yeah.
What does geographical thought do to behavior? And that's been basically what has shaped most of my work has been the impact of geographical thinking on how people function, how they behave.
Yeah. And a lot of your research has been on explorers and the exploratory process. Is that, I mean, that might be a big example of behavior. Are you also talking about sort of everyday behavior and how geographical knowledge shapes what we do every day?
Yeah, how people get around in the world, how they pick routes to get from home to work, how they pick places to go on vacation, how they navigate in Earth space. All of those kinds of things have to do with the way that people think about geography. And by geography, I mean sort of Earth space. I think there's a huge impact on geographical thought or geographical thinking and human behavior. That's why I sort of lump John K. Wright's work with Ralph Brown's work.
Uh-huh.
Because that was Brown's point of view in Mirror for Americans and a number of other works. He talked about the role of the geographical imagination in human behavior, and that people behaved in the world according to what they thought about the world, as opposed to what we might loosely term geographical reality, if there is such a thing.
Yeah. I mean, right. How would we have a geographical reality if we subscribe to what Wright is saying here? Because we have multiple different multiple realities based on the perspective of the person we're talking to or talking with, right?
Yeah, essentially. Although, you know, there are certain immutable facts about geographic reality. It is there's a certain number of statute miles between point A and point B. There's a certain Earth dimensions, and those are things that people can imagine about. But they're also real things. When the temperature is 20 degrees Fahrenheit, as it is here in Laramie right now, that's geographic reality. And we may perceive it differently depending on a number of external things, not the least of which is how hard the wind is blowing.
Right.
You know, we talk about wind chill factors and those kind of things. So I think there is something to the notion of a difference between the geography of reality and the geography of perception, if you will.
Okay. Is that what geosophy is? Is it closer to this geography of perception?
Well, I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
And And when we study geographical thought, what we're doing is studying people's perceptions of the world, any part of the world, as they see it, as they understand it,
right,
which may not necessarily be the same thing as what it actually is.
Yeah. And we're not here just talking about countries and continents. We're also talking about how you think of the movie theater versus how I think of it. I mean, what you think of
yeah.
a neighborhood of Laramie, Wyoming versus how I might think of Laramie, Wyoming.
Sure.
I mean, it happens at all scales. It happens in different spaces. It's not just, okay, I picture the globe as being round versus flat. I mean, that's a good example or one of the many examples, but it's not limited to that. No. I guess I found in your essay in the Geographies of the Mind, so this was a collection of essays put together to sort of, I gather, celebrate the contributions of J.K. Wright to geography. And your essay there, I think you actually, you get into a little bit of what this imagination is, the geographical imagination. And I'm going to read here directly from there. It's like other things related to geographical discovery, the results of exploration are subject to the interpretations, modifications, and inventions of those faculties of the human mind that are collectively called the imagination. So that's, so when you hear the term geographical imagination, I've had other geographers on the show, and I always want to ask them, even how they imagine this term, geographical imagination. Would this define it for you? The interpretations, modifications, and inventions of those faculties of the human mind. In adding the geographical side to it is just, I guess, then how the mind then shapes the space in the earth space, as you've referred to before, around us. Is that?
Words were written a long time ago, obviously, but
right.
They're just as valid for me now as they were when I wrote them. And I really do think that everyone has their worldview, everyone has their perception of the world,
yeah,
or any part of it, and that conditions the way they behave, whether it's an explorer, a businessman, a farmer, whatever.
Yeah, it conditions us. It limits where we go, but it also might spark interest in places we want to go.
Yes, yeah, very much so.
And again, on any scale, it doesn't mean I think of Tahiti as this tropical paradise, and I want to go there. It's also just I want to go where that bird just flew, just to see what's back there and see where that bird maybe flew
yeah.
to. Yeah.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode.
J.K. Wright is this pioneering work in 1946?
He and his brother invented a number of imaginary geographies. In Wright's collections, there are maps drawn of imaginary places, elaborate maps, the contour lines and climate information and the location of urban places and all kinds of things. I don't know whether you're familiar with the work of his brother, Austin Tappan Wright.
I'm not, but I've come in researching, right? I've come across some descriptions of his brother. Yes.
Yeah, he wrote this truly remarkable novel. It's a huge thing, and to the best of my knowledge, it's the only thing that he ever wrote, called Islandia, or Islandia, depending on whether you want to pronounce the S or not.
Right.
And the right did pronounce the S, so it's Islandia.
Uh-huh.
And it's about this imaginary continent in the South Pacific, between South America and Australia, that has its own culture and its own set of cultural mores and standards and patterns of belief and ways of thinking about things and so on. And that novel, I think, was probably written in the 1920s sometime.
Uh-huh.
But certainly even as boys, Jack and his brother had these imaginary places that they created in their head and played with them. And so I think, you know, the presidential address was simply a way of Wright expressing what had been something that was part of his thinking for a very long time.
Yeah.
Since he was a... And...
So it's a personal essay in some ways.
Yeah, exactly. And he told me once that after he had finished, and of course he... written the thing out and delivered the address, and there was this sort of stunned silence, and people didn't even start to applaud until what he told me seemed to be 15 minutes or more after he had finished. Obviously, it wasn't.
This is after the address, you're saying, the presidential address.
At the banquet, at the age of banquet, and people simply didn't know what to make of it. And he said it was a strange feeling to have delivered this thing that he thought revolutionary, and indeed it was revolutionary, although it wasn't picked up by an awful lot of people. And then. To sort of have this reaction on the part of folks that, what? What is he talking about? What did he just say? But, yeah, how do we deal with this? And he said it was sort of an unsettling experience.
Right. Sitting down to before the applause start even, perhaps.
yeah, exactly. And... why wasn't it picked up by more people? Why didn't all of a sudden the chairs of geosophy that he had talked about, why didn't that happen? Why didn't more scholars begin to pick up on his work?
Yeah.
Well, the simple answer is that he never taught. He never had graduate students.
Huh.
He was the director of the American Geographical Society. At the time, he was president of the AAG, and if memory serves, he's the only person who has been both.
Yeah.
The director of the AAGS and the president of the AAG. And his administrative duties as director of the American Geographical Society precluded him from having a university position. And because he didn't have a university position, he never had a cadre of graduate students.
And so the idea is never really diffused.
Yeah, you know how these things work. A professor has an idea and he passes it along to his graduate students and they write dissertations based on their understanding of those ideas and so on. and that just that didn't happen with Wright. My contact with him began as a result of happenstance. I had accepted a fellowship to Clark University,
right?
Partly because one of the top three or four geography programs in the country with a large faculty, and partly because of the people who were there and had intended on being an urban economic quantitative type.
Right.
I had the fortune, the very first class that I had was from a guy named Martin Bowden, who had taught as an adjunct at Dartmouth the year before he came to Clark.
Yeah.
And Wright was at that time living very near the Dartmouth campus in Hanover, New Hampshire. And he and Martin Bowden struck up this friendship, and Bowden understood the nature of his work and what he was doing and so forth. And in a seminar, and I can't remember the title of the seminar, but it was something that all incoming graduate students at Clark had to take. It was the study of geographical thought, or
right,
the history of geography, or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And in that first seminar, Bowden posed the question, wouldn't it be interesting if we knew something about the world view of Thomas Jefferson at the time of the Louisiana Purchase? If we knew something about what he thought lay beyond the Mississippi River, what he thought about the climate, the people, the animals, and so on. Wouldn't that be a fascinating thing to study?
Did you do this in this seminar?
Well, in a way.
Yeah.
When he said that, I said to myself, and keep in mind, this is the first class in my PhD program. I said, well, that's a dissertation topic. And indeed, that's what happened. My dissertation revolved around Jefferson and his geographical imagination, the geosophy of Thomas Jefferson, and his impact on Lewis and Clark, and the ways that they changed American thinking about the West, and so forth. And that really, I think, was probably the first real world application of Wright's geosophy in a doctoral dissertation. Because, as I say, he simply never had been in a position to have graduate students.
Well, let's imagine, and in the spirit of J.K. Wright, and correct me if I pronounce it wrong, but his imaginary place, or this mythical country that he conjured up during his childhood, was it called Crevé?
Yeah, something like that. So I don't remember.
Yeah. Spelled
C-R- island. And...
Yeah. Now, if it had a university, and in that university had a department of geography, and there was a chair of geosophy, as he calls for in the last section of his presidential address, what would a chair of geosophy do? What would be some of the topics, do you think, or the themes that someone... a scholar who's dedicating their life to geosophy, what other kinds of themes might they get into?
Well, I think a lot of it would be historical in nature and would have to do with the development of geographic thought. How do people think about the world? How do people change their views of the world based on new understanding, new interpretation, new scientific discoveries. Part of the reason I became interested in in exploration and discovery was a way of getting at how the imagination conditions behavior, and then how the consequences of the process of exploration changes the way that people think about the world, and in turn changes their behavior. And I think a lot of what someone teaching a course called Geosophy would deal with would be of a historical nature. I also think there are modern kinds of examples that could be built into such a course.
Yeah.
Well, we want to thank John L. Allen for joining us from his home in Wyoming. And we've come to the end of another of our summer reading series. Last year we did it as well. I think it's a great way to bring back some old texts and dig back into the archive and discuss it a little bit. This one's a favorite of our show and perhaps could help explain the genesis even of our show. So again, thanks to John L. Allen. Thanks to Jeffrey Martin, who joined us in the earlier episode, help us frame a little bit the address as well. As always, we want to thank our musical accompaniment here, the song The Water Embers from Art of Escapism. Thanks again for Creative Commons letting us use the song for our show here. Look for us next time. We will be interviewing Yifu Tuan, a very prominent geographer from the 20th century, a humanist like J.K. Wright. We might even talk a little bit about J.K. Wright, so look forward to that. So, without anything else, look for us on iTunes now. We're on iTunes. It's Geographical Imaginations. And as always, we are at www.geographicalimaginations.org. See you next time. Bye.